I thought we'd just watch a little bit of that family and their issues, just because it's such an intimidating title, isn't it? Raise the Ultimate Family. And I just thought it might be a comfort to you that wherever you're at as you come to church this morning, you're not as bad as them. Well, maybe you are, in which case we've got problems that we really do. Yeah, okay. Well, there's lots of things we want to talk about today. Just a quick one. We've been very generously backed in our whole building move by the Annandale Uniting Church, lending us some of their facilities. We're just using every church facility in Annandale the next fortnight. And on Friday at 3 o'clock down the road in the Presbyterian Church, we'll see Kath and Otto get married. And if everybody is invited, and it'll be a terrific afternoon, 3 o'clock Friday afternoon at the Hunter Bailey Church. Task in hand, we are about starting the ultimate relationship. And look, welcome along. If it's your first time with us at church, it's great that you could be with us here this morning. And what we're doing is we're looking at a series, and in all sorts of ways, we're putting the invitation to start the ultimate relationship with God. So today it's raise the ultimate family. Tonight it's being the ultimate lover. Next Sunday morning, we're at it again, and it's meet the ultimate mentor. And then Sunday night next week, we're doing start the ultimate relationship. In a sense, though, all these sessions are pointing towards the Introducing God courses that we're kicking off, and we're beginning them this Tuesday night, this Wednesday night, and this Thursday night in various lounge rooms across the Inner West. I think we've got 10 different lounge room courses starting, and I'll be inviting you to join us in one of those lounge rooms a little later on this morning. But task in hand, it's raise the ultimate family. And I've not spoken on the whole subject of family before in the way we are doing it today. And if I had thought about it before we advertised it, I might have realised how controversial it was and chickened out. The book that I've found most helpful is this one by Kirsten Burkett, The Essence of Family. And if you read that book, you'll realise how much I'm drawing from Kirsten's work in this talk. Kirsten has really done us marvellous service. It's a great book. Families are very important. And it's family life that we get our biggest joys, family life that we have our biggest hurts, and they are the places where we're formed as individuals. Our closest emotional ties are to our families, and it is the biggest tragedy when family goes wrong. And in fact, most of the issues that I talk to people about in counselling situations are to do with the angst over difficult relationship with father, with mother, with children, with brothers, with sisters, and not just me, it's all counselling situations. And be some here today, just coming to church, knowing that this was the title of that we were studying this morning, filled you with angst. What is a family? Don Edgar, the former director of the Institute of Family Studies, as he was retiring, he said, this is his quote, "As director of this institute for 14 years, I've been at pains to emphasise that every individual has a family, that it's not just mum, dad and a few kids, and that the family does not stop at the front door, that all families change over the life course, and that people define themselves on who is and who is not part of their family. Children often include pets and unrelated adults when describing my family." That was Don Edgar. And then, having defined family very diversely and argued that diversity and recognition of diversity in family life was good, he says, and this is his retirement speech as director of the Family Institute, "At the recent New South Wales Premier's Forum on Ageing, I was puzzled by the unblinking acceptance of the term family of choice. We were told family is no longer limited by blood or kin relationships. Family is what we choose it to be, how we define it ourselves. And this can include friends living together, unrelated couples, a single person with a budgie, or a set of people not living together at all, but who regard one another as family." And at that point, the former head of the Institute of Family Studies is saying, hang on, the definition of what is family has gone too far. And he goes on to say, "Surely family is about blood and kin relationships, not about self-defined friendships that come and go. A couple of any sort may live together as family, sharing mutual care and responsibilities. They may even regard themselves as married, with all that implies, but without offspring or adopted children, the ties that bind cease with the end of the relationship, and the family has no continuity through time. That's Don Edgar, former New South Wales director of the Family Institute. Now, there'll be some here in the room today with different reactions to Mr. Edgar's statement. Some will have no problem. Others say, well, I'm struggling with divorce, struggling with infertility. My husband's left, or I left him, or my wife left, or we long for kids, and well, there's same-sex attraction issues floating around. And you put up a title, Raise the Ultimate Family. And or we're trying as parents, and it's really hard. Or we're not even at the point of trying as parents yet. It's just we're struggling as a couple, or I'm single and I wish I wasn't, or I'm single and I'm in bad relationship with my parents, or I'm married and I'm in bad relationship with my parents. And we come up with this title, Ultimate Family. And you think, oh, I've come to church today and the place is a mess, and we had a row in the car on the way here, and marriage is difficult, and it's hard. And God is going to speak to us this morning. Biggest problem in Australia, it's not interest rates. It's family breakdown. It's getting family right. And it is really, really difficult. Now, what can we say, though, that God says about family? Not moving away from any one individual's definition, someone like Don Edgar, what does God say about family? I'm going to go all over the Bible this morning. It's going to be really hard work. If you're with us for the first time, normally our pattern is to work systematically through a chapter of the Bible. We're going everywhere today. And so here we go. We start off at the very beginning of the Bible. We're in Genesis, first page of the Bible. God creates people. God creates the world in the beginning. God created the heavens and the earth. And then what does God do? He creates men and women. Verse 26 of Genesis chapter 1. Then God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, over all the creatures that move on the ground. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful, increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. God, at each stage in the creation process, he looked at what he'd made and said, that is good. When he gets to this point of making humanity male and female in his image, he looks at his creation, at the first man and the first woman, and says, that is good. God was very pleased. But then almost immediately, something goes wrong, very wrong. In this good world that God has made, the man and the woman declare autonomy. They go their own way. They do their own thing. They reject the God who made them. And they weren't content with what God has given them. They eat the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil that God had said not to eat from. God is angry at that point. He says to that first man, first woman, to Adam, to Eve, you have done wrong. And in punishment, he expels them from the garden and pronounces a curse on their relationship. You can read about it, Genesis chapter 3, sentence 16. But it's the beginning of a power struggle between the man and the woman in family life. And it's that same power struggle that echoes down through the generations to today. And instead of mutual love and mutual care and mutual putting the other, the pair are fighting. The pair are attempting to dominate the other. And the man, instead of using his natural strength to serve his wife, uses it to dominate her. And that terrible pain is played out in millions of marriages across the world. But God had a plan to fix things, a plan to put things right, a plan for an ultimate family. And We're going to see how that happens in the next few minutes. First, what God does is forms a people. He chooses a family. He says to a goat herder, Abram, Abram, I'm picking you. You're going to be the father in my fam. I'm blessing you. And so Genesis chapter 12, the Lord said to Abram, leave your country, your people, your father's household. Go to the land I'll show you. I'll make you into a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great. And you will be a blessing. I'll bless those who bless you. Whoever curses you, I'll curse. All peoples on earth will be blessed through you. And then there is enormous interest in the Bible on the whole subject of who will be the children of Abraham. Who is Abraham's family? And the family tree is closely monitored. And we follow it. Abraham, he's the father. And then Isaac, he's the father. And then Jacob, and God changes Jacob's name to Israel. And who are the children of Israel? And the family of Abraham becomes the nation of Israel. And the identity of who is in God's family, of who is in God's nation, is totally caught up with their relationship with one man, their father, Abraham. And within the nation of Israel, there are all sorts of subgroups, tribes. And the head of each of the leader, the identifying person of each of the tribes, I mean, their geographical tribes, their political subgroups, every individual in the nation of Israel is known as not just a son of Abraham, a child of Abraham, a daughter of Abraham, but they're a child of Levi, or Judah, or Issachar, or Dan, or one of the other leaders of the 12 tribes, the 12 sons of Jacob of Israel. Controversial statement coming up. These days, definition of family, popular idea of family. Often it's mum, dad, kids. Often it's mum who's central. Often it's her who forms family identity. But it is absolutely clear in the Bible that it's Abraham, that it's Isaac, that it's Jacob. Here's the controversial statement. In Israel, there's no family without a father. It's the father that defines the group of cohabiting people as being the family unit. A family is a father-headed unit. A father is central to the concept and existence of a family. He's the head, the source, the one who holds it together. And it's tragic. It had massive implications for the whole unit if the father turns from God. Doesn't take long, though, for the husband to find a wife. And the Bible, to be a father, a man needs a woman. And in the Bible, God is very positive about marriage and the sexual relationship. You see, chapter 5 of Song of Songs, I slept, but my heart was awake. Listen, my lover is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my darling, my dove, my flawless one. My head is drenched with dew, my hair with the dampness of the night. I've taken off my robe. Must I put it on again? I've washed my feet. Must I soil them again? My lover thrust his hand through the latch opening. My heart began to pound for him. And there is the beautiful picture of the man and the woman coming together in marriage. It is the teaching of the Bible that relationship between a man and a woman should be monogamous, faithful. Ten Commandments of Exodus 20, you shall not commit adultery. Adultery in Israelite law is one of the most serious commands. To commit adultery strikes at the very heart of the marriage commitment of openness and honesty between the man and the woman. There is in Israel a respect for fatherhood, but there is a deep commitment to the equality of man and woman. High honor for woman. Proverbs 31, the mother, a wife of noble character, who can find? She is worth far more than rubies. Her husband has full confidence in her and lacks nothing of value. She brings him good, not harm, all the days of her life. She selects wool and flax and works with eager hands. She's like the merchant ships, bringing her food from afar. She gets up while it's still dark. She provides food for her family and portions for her servant girls. She considers a field and buys it. Out of her earnings, she plants a vineyard. She sets about her work vigorously. Her arms are strong for her tasks. She sees that her trading is profitable and her lamp does not go out at night. High honor for mothers, high honor for wives. And children, Israel stands out as a community in the ancient world as distinctively different to the nations around it. God's people, God's family is distinctively different. It is the country that does not sacrifice their children to their gods. The Israelite people saw that as abhorrent because God saw it as abhorrent. They didn't leave their kids to die. They placed high value on children. And it is that teaching of the Bible, that view of the Bible, that has shaped our view in Western culture on that point. And then a great deal of time is spent on the educating of children, starting with right knowledge of God. Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7, the fear of the Lord is the beginning, the first point of knowledge. And so the model we have in the Old Testament is of a family with the father at the center, initiating, establishing the family predominantly. Predominantly, it's actually still that way in our culture today, in that it is the man who asks the woman to marry him. It's him who takes the initiative. And together, the man and the woman run the household, taking care of the domestic affairs, community affairs, teaching their kids about the beginning of knowledge, the fear of the Lord. That's the idea. That's the ideal. Of course, right from page 3 of the Bible, people have been rejecting God, not doing it his way. But that is God's Old Testament picture of family. What about in Jesus' time? What about in the teaching of Jesus, the New Testament? What is that part of the Bible's teaching on family? And here is God's directive to husbands. Husbands, Ephesians chapter 5, sentence 25. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. Here's what the man is to do. To love wife. To love my wife. How do I love my wife? As Christ loved his people. Well, what did Christ do? Well, he became flesh. God in the flesh. 30 years of life. Gave himself up for his people. Died for his people. Why did the church need dying for? Well, Adam, Eve, all of us had rebelled against God. Adam, Eve, all of us were under the judgment of God. And Christ took that judgment. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy. Christ died to make his people holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Husbands, are to love wives like Christ did. Lay down their life for their wife, like Christ laid down his life for his church. I've quoted this at weddings before, but I kept the Daily Telegraph Mirror from the 11th of June 1993 because I was so struck by the front page of the Daily Telegraph Mirror that day. The heading on the front page of the Telegraph Mirror was, I loved him. He took his own life for me. Newlywed Debbie Ford yesterday held a memorial service at the spot where her husband sacrificed his life to save her from the jaw of a white pointer shark. Shattered at losing him just 15 days after their wedding, Mrs. Ford returned by boat to the Byron Bay diving site where her husband John was killed by the 5-meter shark on Wednesday. The grieving wife said goodbye to the man she loved, her hero. He took his own life for me, Mrs. Ford sobbed. He was a hero and a good husband. He was a good husband because he loved like Christ loved. He acted like Christ did. He exercised personal, self-sacrificial, costly love, John Ford, dying for Debbie Ford. And it was great. Why have I kept a newspaper article from 1993? Kathy and I, we were married on the 24th of April, 1993. John and Debbie Ford were married on the 25th of May, 1993. We came back from our honeymoon, and there was the front page of the paper. There was the example as to how I, as young husband, was to put my wife's interests ahead of mine. We promised to do it. Better, worse, sickness, health. Why did Christ do it? Verse 26, to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. Jesus' aim in dying for his people was that on the last day, he might present to God a holy people, a blameless people. And what is my actions as a husband to be? That on the last day my wife might be blameless. That on the last day my wife might be holy. I am to act in such a way to encourage her relationship with God. Now, what else in terms of fatherhood? Well, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. You know that we dealt with each of you as a father deals with his own children, encouraging and comforting and urging you to live lives worthy of God who calls you into his kingdom and glory. At that point, I'm not just concerned about my wife being holy on the last day. I'm also concerned about children holy on the last day. Encouraging, comforting, urging them to live lives worthy of God. I'm going to speak to the dads for a moment. Gentlemen, it's our role. It's our task to be setting the norm in our households, to be encouraging our families to live lives worthy of God. How would you do it? How could you be encouraging family to live lives worthy of God? Well, I think it's primarily like we do it in church. How do we encourage people in church to live lives worthy of God? We do it by opening the Bible, by reading the Bible. And so I take it that the task of the father, key task of the father, is to be initiating, spurring the family on to Bible reading, to listening to God, to speaking to God in prayer. And I take it that is particularly a task of the husbands. If the wife is supportive of it, if the wife is doing that, even better. But it's particularly the husband's role. Now, what about mothers? Well, questions, comments in a moment. Mothers, and marriage first, clear affirmation again in the New Testament of the importance of marriage as lifelong monogamous commitment. Matthew 5:32, I tell you, Jesus speaking, Sermon on the Mount, anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness causes her to become an adulteress. And anyone who marries the divorced woman commits adultery. He's absolutely clear. Matthew 19, sentence 3, Jesus speaking again. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Haven't you read? He replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife and the two will become one flesh. So they're no longer two but one. Therefore, what God has joined together, let man not separate. Jesus is non-negotiably, absolutely clear here. one flesh. Were two, now one, no separation. What if you do break up? Kathy and I break up. I can't move on to the next one. That's absolutely clear here in the words of Jesus. Why then? They asked, did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away? Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for marital unfaithfulness and marries another commits adultery. There's a unity that Jesus is talking about here, a oneness. And how does it play out in God's ideal family, in relationship between husband and wife? Well, we've seen that the husband is to lay down his life for the wife. And the wife? Well, Paul teaches here, God's apostle Paul, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church's body, of which he is the Savior. As the church submits to Christ, so wives should submit to their husbands in everything. As the husband acts for her good, as Christ acts for the good of his people, she says, I'll follow you, husband, knowing that you'll act for my good. As a Christian says, I'll follow you, Jesus, knowing that you'll act for my good. You say, oh, Dominic, that is just so politically incorrect. That is just so out of step with Western culture. Yeah? But Western culture has the highest divorce rate of any culture in history. And perhaps somebody needs to be the one who comes out and says, well, we're really, really scientifically advanced and we've got iPhones. And isn't it wonderful? You can make an iPhone, but you can't make a marriage. And here is the call of the Bible. Here is ultimate family. The husband, following Jesus' example, putting his wife's interests first, and the wife saying, I trust you and I'll follow you. Why wouldn't you? I asked a group of women why it's difficult to follow their husbands. And the answer for each one was, I don't trust him, I think I can do better, and I'm not sure he'll act in my best interest. And it is exactly the same for people with Christ. Why do I have problems following Christ? It's because I don't trust him, I think I can do better, and I'm not sure he'll act in my best interest. It's the same problem, it's the heart of wanting to rebel. What about kids? Children. Jesus speaking positively about children. See how completely different the worldview is about from Christ here to the atheist worldview. Jesus speaking, let the little children come to me and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these. Jesus is so positive about children. That's why we as a church family are so positive about children. Interesting, in 1 Timothy, one of the requirements of a church leader is that they be able to manage their children, be able to raise their children well. And so 1 Timothy 3 verse 4, he must manage his own family well and see that his children obey him with proper respect. If anyone does not know how to manage his own family, how can he take care of God's church? I read that verse in the Bible. And I think God is saying to me, if I can't get it right at home, then I need to look for a different job. I must get it right at home. Now, we've looked at Old Testament. We've looked at New Testament with Jesus. What about the future? What about heaven? What's the heavenly perspective? Well, there is a heavenly perspective, a picture of family in heaven. And in Ephesians chapter 3, in Paul's letter to the Ephesians, you come next week, it'll be simpler. Paul's letter to the Ephesians, we'll take questions and comments at the moment. Ephesians chapter 3, for this reason, I kneel before the Father, from whom his whole family in heaven and on earth derives its name. Here's the picture of God in heaven, from whom his whole family derives its name. What does that mean? Well, probably perhaps better to see it the original text. For this reason, I kneel before the Father, from whom all father-headed units in heaven and on earth derive their name. God is the Father. God is the Father who names, who creates, who determines the nature of all families. And all our families, every family here, every father-headed unit here, is somehow a pale, corrupt, distorted photocopy of God. But heading up the ultimate family is the Father in heaven, which means my family, your family, can never be ultimate. For there's an ultimate family in heaven. Our families are penultimate. In fact, there's an error that people make, and you see people making this in our community all the time, of worshipping my family as if it is ultimate. And yet Jesus is quite clear. How am I to think about my family, given that there is an ultimate family in heaven? Well, Jesus says, if anyone comes to me, if anyone comes to Jesus and does not hate his father, Jesus speaking, Luke 14:26, if anyone comes to me and does not hate his father, his mother, his wife, his children, his brothers, his sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. I don't think Jesus is saying he goes spit on your mum. I don't think that's the line he's running with. Ten commandments, we're to honour our father and mother. Now, what Jesus is saying, though, is that the allegiance to him must be so great that it is in comparison, my allegiance to him compared to all my other earthly relationships, they're nothing. Even though they may in and of themselves be actually very important. Now, last two points, and then we'll open for questions and comments. I want to put at this point in this address a question boldly to you. And I'm about to put the question that I actually think is the most important point that I'm going to make in this address. And the question is, where are you in terms of God's family? When Jesus came, it was God become flesh. And the one who made the world became part of this world. I'll just show you that from the opening verses of John's Gospel. He was in the world. Jesus, he was in the world. And though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. Jesus was walking down the beach, and people did not recognize that the guy on the beach was the one who made the world. And he came to that which was his own. Verse 11, but his own did not receive him. Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision, or a husband's will, but born of God. And so the question really in terms of ultimate family is, are you in? Now, we're not talking about birth. We're not talking about natural descent. We're not talking of human decision or a husband's will. Are you in? Are you adopted into the family of Jesus? How does that work? Well, just looking at verse 11, looking at verse 12, have you received Jesus? His own did not receive him, yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, verse 12, he gave the right, he adopted, that they might become children of God. What does it look like to have received Jesus? What does it look like to have believed in his name? Well, I take it means to recognize that he came in the flesh. To recognize that he did die. That I might be holy. That you might be holy. It's recognizing Jesus and putting him above all. Above mother, brother, sister, parents, children. And to receive Jesus like that, to believe in his name like that, is to be received into the family of God and be in that ultimate family in heaven for eternity. But to reject Jesus is in the end to be rejected from that family of God and excluded from heaven for eternity. It is a big topic. It is an enormous topic. It requires a lot of thought, which is why we've organized these Introducing God courses. Starting this week on Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Thursday night. It's the first of 9 weeks, 8-9 weeks of thinking, discussing, analyzing, processing. You say, oh, I've got something more important. Busy week. Well, Jesus says, you can't come to me unless you hate your father, mother, wife, children, brothers, sisters, even own life. He says, I am the most important, and you won't get off first base unless you recognize that. So I want to suggest, change your diary. How do I say I want to come? We'll take feedback on the comment cards in a moment. We'll ask everybody to fill them in a couple of moments' time and ask you to indicate that you'd like to be come Tuesday night, come Wednesday night, come Thursday night, and then somebody will ring you up and invite you to that particular one. Let me give you my conclusion. Raising the ultimate family, we called it this morning. What about raising the ultimate family? Well, here's the catch. We don't. God does. God is the father of the ultimate family. So, ultimately, raising the ultimate family is not us, but God. Well, how do I play a part as a child who's been adopted into God's ultimate family? Having been adopted by God into that family, now I'm in the family. Now I have received Jesus. Now I have believed in his name. Now I've accepted what he's done for me and dying for me. Now I've actually started to say no to some of those things. There are all sorts of norms in God's family, as there are norms in every other family. All sorts of expectations about how family life will play out now that I'm adopted into the family of God. The Father wants to be honored. The Father wants to speak to us. The Father wants us to listen to him. The Father wants his kids to talk to us. And so we need to prioritize all sorts of things around our relationship with our ultimate Father, God. For me, it plays out that I find myself speaking to God many times a day about all sorts of things. Sometimes they're big things, sometimes they're little things. But I find myself, oh, dear God, what do I do about this? Dear God, can you help me here? Dear God, can you guide me here? I'm always talking to him. And he guides me, leads me in everything. What about, well, me as a parent in raising my family, my penultimate family? Well, the thing that I want for my family most is that they be adopted into God's ultimate family, so that God too might raise them in his ultimate family. So again, I want to prioritize listening to God. I want to prioritize reading his word as a family. We're going on a 3-month holiday as a family on the 1st of September. And Kath and I, the last few months, one of our big subjects has been, what of our hopes? What do we want to do? My big hope for our holiday, the really big thing that I hope for our holiday, is that every day for the 12 weeks we're away, as a family, we'd open the Bible. As a family, we'd read the Bible. I think in family life in Sydney, we aim for every day, but it is so busy, so hectic, so stressful. We get there several times a week, but not every day. And on holidays, I want to do better. And so if you're going to pray for our family while we go on holidays the next 12 weeks or after the 1st of September, please pray that we'd read the Bible as a family. That it'll be key for helping our children being adopted into God's ultimate family. And I take it that that is the hope and the prayer of every Christian parent, but I hope that it would be the prayer of every person here. Well, that's all I've got to say in my notes this morning, but do you want to ask a question or make a comment at this point? Going. I thought we were going to have a doozy of a question time this morning. Well, Fred's question or comment is about emphasis are given for various families. I would say that there is an extraordinary amount of emphasis on how to have a healthy child. Do you know our children have done healthy eating as a term project every year for the last 4 years? I mean, they are so educated on how to eat healthily. It's the parents who still believe in McDonald's and the other four food groups of Kentucky Fried. But also, there is so much pressure on us, particularly in this part of Sydney, on upskilling children. And in that there's so much pressure on us to have your children fully able to swim and fully able to play three musical instruments and fully able to play tennis and soccer and cricket. And there is so much pressure for extracurricular activities that there's just no time, yet there is almost nothing that puts value and nothing that encourages value on actual moral responsibility. And because if you start to talk about moral responsibility, you've then got to talk about why, and our society, our secular society, has got no kind of answer for that. And so it's only that we actually can go back to the scriptures and have a conversation about why and what does God say about that point. Yeah. We will pray. I'm around over morning tea if you want to pick me up. I know I've dropped lots of bombs this morning, and I'm very open to talk about any of the issues that I've raised. So do speak to me about any of the issues that we've raised. And one of the dads of our church, Ian Foster, is going to come and lead us in prayer now. Thanks, Ian.